From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Michael Harrington is arguably the leading socialist in the United States. His 1962 book, The Other America, inspired the war on poverty. Now at age 60, he has cancer, but he says facing his own mortality is no reason to turn his back on atheism. Michael Harrington reflects on his life on today's Fresh Air. We also examine the changing image of dance with Village Voice dance critic Deborah Jowett. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from violinist Billy Bang, and television critic David Bianculli reviews Try to Remember, CBS's condensation of 1 week in American life. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Michael Harrington has tried to live his life in a way that's consistent with his political beliefs, and he hopes he hasn't been self-righteous about it. Harrington is frequently described as America's foremost socialist. His 1962 bestseller, The Other America, described the poverty that more prosperous Americans were largely unaware of at the time. After John F. Kennedy read the book, he proposed federal anti-poverty programs, which led to Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. Harrington now co-chairs the Democratic Socialists of America, which he describes as part of the liberal labor wing of the Democratic Party. He's also a professor of political science at Queens College and a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. Harrington has devoted his life to social change and sees himself as a long-distance runner, even though the finish line keeps receding. Now at the age of 60, Harrington's pace has been slowed by cancer. He's written an autobiography titled The Long Distance Runner. He opens by explaining how in 1949 he became a social worker for opportunistic reasons. He wanted a job so he could save money to eventually go to New York and be a poet and bohemian. But what he witnessed in his work changed his life.
It all began in St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up. My family was deeply involved in the Democratic Party, and through political pull, I got a job at the St. Louis Board of Education as a social worker. As a matter of fact, I think this particular job was invented, particularly for me, because of political influence. And I took the job with no higher interest than simply saving up enough money, coming to New York, finding Greenwich Village, and settling down to the work of becoming a poet. And suddenly, I found myself on the a section of St. Louis down by the levee, down by the Mississippi River, working with the children of white Arkansas sharecroppers and encountering for the first time in my life face-to-face poverty. And there is one particular day which was sort of my Saul on the road to Damascus moment. On that day, it was a rainy day in the early fall. The houses in which the poor lived in this area were actually very beautiful houses. They had come from the old St. Louis. Some of them were French. They had French windows. They had courtyards. Only in the courtyard you would find outdoor johns and open faucets and mud and filthy children. And on this rainy day, I went into one of these houses, and suddenly the smell was so horrible that I was practically nauseated. It was the smell of dead rats, of stopped-up toilets, of cooking smells, of too much living, of too much poverty, of too many people jammed into a small space. And that oppressive smell sort of broke through my middle-class existence. Middle-class people don't have noses. And made poverty something to me existential, something so unmistakable.
It's interesting to me that you wanted to stay around and help to see what you could and help see what you could do about it, as opposed to fleeing the stench.
Well, what happened was, when I left that house, I literally said to myself, I must spend the rest of my life doing something about this.
Now, a lot of people go through a period in their life, especially when they're in their teens or in their 20s, where they say just that, I must go through life doing something about this. And then they get a few years older and they figure, well, I've put in my time, I've paid my dues, now it's time to think about me and my family. And they kind of drop out from that life of commitment to go about a more conventional middle-class life. That never exactly happened to you.
Well, that gets back to something that I tried to explain a bit in my new book, The Long Distance Runner, which is that it seems to me that as far back as I can remember, that is to say, as far back as when I was 4 years old in kindergarten at St. Rose's School, and skipping lunch so I could give my lunch money to the nuns so I could help save a baby for Christ in China, that as far back as at the age of four, I had a commitment somehow to act in the world, to change the world. And one of the things that I think about my life, which has now been since that day in St. Louis, well over 40 years of commitment, is that it's really no credit to me that I had to do it, that it was born in me, that it was something that I was, that it was almost a fate. It's hard to explain. And I don't want to say, by the way, that after that moment in St. Louis and that house down by the levee, I never turned back, because I came to New York, I hung around the village, I did my fair share of drinking, I had an enormous amount of fun. I did not become a solemn, puritanical struggler against injustice. But it is true that from that moment on, my life changed, and it shaped, I think, the rest of my life.
My guest is Michael Harrington, co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America and author of many books, including his new memoir, The Long Distance Runner. Now, that said, you've still gone through certain experiences that have tempered the way you've expressed your commitment to social change. For instance, you write in your new memoir that when you became a father, you discovered a certain willingness to be selfish and you lost some of your inhibitions about making money.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah.
Because one of the things, it is one thing to have a bohemian poverty, which I had for many years,
mm-hmm.
or for the 2 years that I lived at the Catholic Worker, a religiously based poverty. It's one thing to have that poverty for yourself. It's one thing for me as an individual to live in sort of rotten places and eat cheap food and skimp. But it's another thing when there are innocent little babies who did not ask for a life of poverty, who are your children, whom you love, whom you're responsible for. And I think that fatherhood, parenthood, may be one of the great bourgeoisifying experiences of all time. It certainly was for me.
So how did it change you? What specifically did you do differently in the ways you went about making a living and where you lived?
Well, it made the difference, number one, that when I first became somewhat successful at the age of 35, when the other America made quite an impact on this country, suddenly people began to ask me to speak and to pay me money for speaking. And strange as it may sound, I was terribly upset by suddenly making money. It was one of the most difficult experiences in my life, because as a bohemian radical with practically no money, and I managed to have practically no money until I was 35 years of age, there were no ambiguities, there were no possible hypocrisies. But suddenly in the mid-60s, when people would pay me the unheard of sum to me of $500 for giving a speech, I didn't know what to do. Once I became a father, I knew what to do. Ask for $750 and try to make more money.
So how old were you when you became a father?
I was 40 years of age, and that was a real shift, a psychic shift in my life. It eventually led me to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Your wife says something very funny that you quote her as saying in the book, when you realized you wanted to move to the suburbs in part because the schools that your children were about to enter were very tough schools where they'd have to defend themselves in order to get an education. Your wife said to you, well, what is the appropriate suburb for America's foremost socialist to move to?
That's true.
An interesting question.
Well, as a matter of fact, she refused to look for a house in Scarsdale on the grounds that for my public image, having a Scarsdale address would be too much. So we went to Larchmont, but the New York Post attacked me anyway.
Where is Larchmont?
It's in Westchester. It's not too far from Scarsdale, mm-hmm. and it's a nice middle-class suburb. There's a few rich people there, but it's no more, no less than the middle class. I like it. I was in love with New York in the way that a 21-year-old from St. Louis falls in love with New York when I came in 1949. I left Manhattan and the village reluctantly and even bitterly, because I simply couldn't afford it because of the problem of schools and my kids, the problem of subways and my kids. But at the same time, even when I was at my most holy and pure at the Catholic Worker, living in voluntary poverty, eating just god-awful food. I always used to say to myself, I'm not against good food. I'm not against clean sheets. I'm not against good wine. They're terrific things. I'm against the way they're distributed. But I never got into that kind of perverse saintliness where you make a positive joy out of the fact that the food you're eating is no good. So that when I got to the suburbs, it was a contradiction. I still feel torn between my radical egalitarianism and the fact that I lead a middle-class life. But on the other hand, I happen to think that a nice house and squirrels in the trees and those kinds of things are not bad at all. They're quite good. What I would like to see is for everybody in the United States to, and everybody in the world to have the chance to live that kind of a life.
Do you ever feel that you've judged some other middle-class people too harshly?
Not really. I must say that even when I was at my most radical and my most pure, both in theory and in practice, and had no money and all the rest, I always understood that you don't look down on the compromises that other people make. Life is a compromise. Everybody makes compromises. Nobody is really pure. I understood that at my purest. I also, by the way, understood, let's say, when I was at the Catholic Worker, 2 years of living with alcoholics under very difficult conditions. We were impure there, too. The Catholic Worker was, for example, a pacifist community. Yet we often had problems of violence. People from the Bowery are not always quiet. People coming off of terrible drunks sometimes get violent. There was one man in the house, Tom Sullivan, who was not a pacifist. And when the violence would break out, we would always call for Tom Sullivan. That is to say, we could not handle it in a completely Gandhian way. Nobody is perfect. So I'm for some reason, I had a certain spirit of charity, even at the time when I felt the least tension, the least hypocrisy. And thank God I didn't condemn the middle class as such, because I'm sure a member of it now.
Well, I think a lot of people, when they move to the suburbs, feel like, well, you know, if they've been liberal or leftist before, feel, well, now I have to revise my philosophy to bring it into step with the way I'm actually living. You've actually, I think, had a lot of radical friends who've become very conservative, who've really switched totally to the other end.
Yes, but that did not happen to them because they moved to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, and it's one of the sad parts of my life history. Some of the people whom I knew when I was in my 20s, in the 1950s, who were radicals with me, we belonged to an organization which was the youth organization of a group on the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations. The FBI used to take a live interest in us. We were opposed to the Korean War. Our members were sometimes given discharges from the armed forces on less than honorable circumstances, simply for being members of ours, and so forth and so on. People whom I knew under those circumstances, who stood up against the FBI, who fought the majority current of the society relentlessly, later, primarily I think because of an obsessive anti-communism, came over and supported the war in Vietnam, in effect. And I was much too slow in breaking with some of those friends, I think, as I look back. And one of the reasons was I could not bring myself to believe, that friends of mine who had stood up against the FBI on the issue of the Korean War had actually gone over to support the war in Vietnam. And yet, the thing I would emphasize is that I think that these people did this for very wrong reasons, in my opinion, but not for dishonorable reasons. They didn't do it for money. They didn't do it for power or prestige or houses in the suburbs. They did it because they believed in it. I think they were terribly wrong.
Yet you're sorry you didn't break with them sooner.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because I think, and if I have any fault to assign them, it's this, that they knew they had changed, and they didn't tell me. I think, though, that I was stupid in being so slow, so trusting, relying so much on those memories of our good old days and our radical youth, not to know that I should have broken with them earlier.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break before we continue our conversation some more. My guest is Michael Harrington, who is co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America and the author of 14 books on social policy and political theory, including The Other America and The New American Poverty. His new book is a memoir titled The Long Distance Runner. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Michael Harrington is my guest, his new memoir titled The Long Distance Runner. Do you feel in the course of your political activism over the years that you've had to face the shattering of beliefs or of illusions over time, that you've been disappointed in certain countries or in certain people who had been models to you at one time and then went wrong, turned cynical, turned bad in some way?
Not in a strange way, my answer is no. And I'll tell you why it's strange. Take, for example, the triumph of the French socialists in 1981, when François Mitterrand was elected president and the socialists got a majority in the parliament and proceeded to enact their program into law. I had high hopes for that. I knew Mitterrand. I knew the French socialists. I had spent a fair amount of time in France. And I thought, finally, perhaps we're going to have a breakthrough where we socialists will demonstrate in practice that we can really run a modern society with justice and with efficiency and with growth. And they didn't. I was in France teaching at the University of Paris in 1983 at one of the worst periods of that socialist failure. So was I disappointed? Enormously, of course. Did it disillusion me? No. And the reason is that from the very first moment I became a socialist, long before I had ever read Antonio Gramsci, I had what you might call a Gramscian perspective. That is to say, I have always understood that socialism is something that is not going to be achieved in my lifetime or the lifetime of my children. Indeed, that socialism may be something that is never achieved. That socialism is something to be created. It's not a sure thing. It's not a historic guarantee. That if socialism does triumph long after I'm dead, it will do so after a terribly long process of defeats as well as victories. And therefore, my attitude has been almost from the very first that when I am disappointed in this or that socialist project or this or that socialist leader, it does not lead to disillusionment, because in a sense, I have always expected that this is going to be a long, ambiguous, and difficult struggle. And I've never asked anything more than the right to participate in it.
You know, there's probably a lot of people in the United States who would be more comfortable with your egalitarian ideas if you didn't label them as socialism, because socialism, to the minds of a lot of people in the United States, is the same thing as communism, and to a lot of people, they're both almost dirty words politically, dangerous words.
And no question about it. But why then do I stick to the word socialist?
Right.
Well, for a number of reasons. Number one, If I believe, as I do, that a radical restructuring of society is taking place, it's taking place right now, that the issue is not whether we are going to have radical change in the next 10, 20, 30 years. That's settled. We are. The issue is whether that radical change is going to come from above, whether it's going to be authoritarian, elitist, whether it's going to be at the expense of the people of the third world abroad and the people of the third world within the United States. or whether it is possible for there to be an actual democratic bottom-up control of this enormous transition in human affairs that we are living through. Now, if I understand that as a basic proposition, and that's the in a sense, the political proposition that has animated my life, and I would say, I won't call this socialism. Number one, somebody else immediately will. They will say, you can't get away with that, that's socialism. And they would be right. And the people who have tried this, some years ago, Tom Hayden had the Campaign for Economic Democracy in California. And many of the people regarded economic democracy as sort of a code word for the S word. We'll call it economic democracy, we won't call it socialism. But what happened is people would immediately say, but that's socialism. I remember talking to Tom Hayden, first time he ran for the state assembly. And I told him that Democratic Socialists of America were going to support him. He said, you better, I get called a socialist all the time. The point is that I believe America has to grow up. America is the only country, the only advanced industrial country in the world, which gets the vapors when you use the word socialism, which has this misunderstanding. And either we get over that, or else we will not simply be anti-socialist. We are anti-socialist. But because of this childish attitude towards socialism, we will have a less than decent liberalism. America is a society with a right and a center and no left. That's the fundamental problem. That has not to do with semantics. That has to do with historic political reality. I want to change it.
My guest is Michael Harrington, and he's written a memoir about his life in politics titled The Long Distance Runner. I want to ask you something else, another subject, a very personal one that you bring up in your new book, and that's cancer. And you're dealing with cancer now, cancer of the esophagus. And before that, you had cancer by your tongue.
Right.
So you've already been through a long series of radiation therapy and I think chemotherapy as well.
Chemotherapy now, yeah.
You write in your book that when you realized you had cancer, you were thinking about the possibility of imminent death. And you decided, well, that was no reason to turn your back on atheism.
Right.
And I'd like to ask you a little bit about the kind of dialogue that went on in your own mind about whether this was going to be a time for you to become religious in a way that you hadn't been religious before, or whether you were just going to be the way you'd been and deal with illness with the same kind of ground rules that you lived your life.
Well, you see, as I mentioned in The Long Distance Runner, although I've been an atheist for 30 years or so, I consider myself a religious person. That is to say, the religious emotion is something that moves me. I grew up a Catholic. I still have enormous respect and even love for the church. My only problem with the church is I don't believe in it. And so religious thoughts are never that far away from me, although I must say that in the 30 years between leaving the church and getting cancer, I never had any particular desire to go back. But I love Gregorian chant. I read religious writings. I've written a book on religion and politics, so forth and so on. When I got cancer, when I began to look at an imminent death, obviously the question then raised itself, well, do you want to revise this? And I just saw no reason to. I mean, I'm afraid. I don't believe in Catholicism or any other religion, but certainly if I went back to religion, I assume it would be Catholicism I would go back to. I don't believe in it. And I felt that having lived my life believing that when I die, that's it. That's the end of Michael Harrington. There is no more. Oh, I will be remembered by my friends, and perhaps if my books survive for a while, I might be remembered by people who are not my friends in the future. But I feel that one has to face up to this reality. And indeed, a man who played a significant role in my life, the man who for six times was the presidential candidate of the Socialist Party, Norman Thomas. Thomas was an ordained Protestant minister. He was a Presbyterian minister. He, too, had broken with religion, not publicly, but in his own life and mine. And I used to visit Norman Thomas at the very end of his life when he was in a nursing home out in Long Island. And one of the things that I admired enormously about him was there he was blind in that last period of his life, waiting for death, anxiously hoping for death, but he was stoic about it. He understood death as something that was inevitable, death as something at that point that he welcomed. And he and I both, I suppose, but because we both came from religious backgrounds, would often talk about religious questions. But he did not make any move to go back. And I, that example perhaps was in my mind. But I'm, as I told my cousin, who is a nun, if I die and discover I'm wrong and there is a God, I'm not afraid of that God.
I want to quote something that you say in your book, and I really respected this. You said, you know, you'd been through, you know, dealing with cancer and all the treatments, all the terrible treatments you had to go through, and you came out of the first round, and you said to yourself, "What did I learn? Nothing but cliches." I really respected you for saying that, because I think at this point we're really putting a lot of pressure on people who are ill or who have cancer to reach some kind of enlightenment because they're suffering and because they're facing the possibility of death, that we look to them for a certain wisdom and they're supposed to like be changed because of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And I must say that when you're on a when you're on a cancer ward, when you're going through chemotherapy, actually, you're dealing with immediate things of the IVs in your arms. Of the fact that I was there quite recently, and of the fact that somebody died two doors away, and I, in a sense, heard the last moments of that person because they were voluble. There is that reality, and there's really not much to say about it. There's someone, as a matter of fact, I won't use her name, a rather well-known woman. I find out lots of people tell me they've had cancer because I have cancer. They're sort of a club of us folks. And this woman surprised me by saying that she had had cancer, but she didn't tell anybody because she didn't think that there was anything anybody had particularly to learn from it. And she faced up to it, and that was that. And I think that's an admirable attitude.
But you've told people about it.
I told people about it because I had to, because I am the co-chair of Democratic Socialists of America. It's not just my life. There's an organization in which I am deeply involved, and I had to tell the organization because the organization had to deal with the fact that I was for a period of time not able to play the role I had. I'm playing more of a role again. I have no idea how much time I've got left. I'm apparently doing fairly well in my fight, but my existence remains, I must say, precarious.
Well, I want to wish you the best with your health, and I really thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your life and your politics. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad I could be here.
My guest has been Michael Harrington, and he's the co-chair of Democratic Socialists of America. He's written many books, including The Other America. His new memoir is titled The Long Distance Runner. It's published by Henry Holt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Estelle Friedman. She's the author of Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides, publishers of Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Why do today's audiences favor ballerinas that are lithe and athletic, when in the 1830s, audiences preferred their dancers ethereal and mysterious? That's the type of question dance critic Deborah Jowett addresses in her new book, Time and the Dancing Image. It's an investigation of the ways changes in society lead to changes in dance. Coming up, we speak with Deborah Jowett. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from violinist Billy Bang and his sextet. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Try to Remember. It's TV's latest attempt at a time capsule show, a program made up of equal parts archival footage and nostalgia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Haitian Army General Henri Namphy has formed a new military government and declared himself president after violently overthrowing civilian President Leslie Manigat. Manigat and his family have gone into exile in the neighboring Dominican Republic. Alan Tomlinson has more from the Haitian capital.
A 21-gun salute from the grounds of the National Palace shook the city center this morning. It was the signal that Haiti's brief interlude of civilian leadership was emphatically over. Shortly afterwards, General Namphy, flanked by his lieutenants, his wife, and small daughter, appeared on television to proclaim himself Haiti's new president at the head of a military junta. Prominent among his entourage were Defense Minister General Williams Regalat and a former chief of the Presidential Guard, Colonel Prosper Avril. The same two faces, inscrutable and stern, were alongside General Namphy on a similar occasion in February 1986, when the Haitian army took over from the ousted Duvalier family, which had faithfully served for the previous three decades. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Haiti.
The Office of Independent Counsel Lawrence Walsh today announced another indictment in the Iran-Contra affair. Joseph Fernandez, the former CIA station chief in Costa Rica, is charged with five counts of conspiracy and making false statements. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Joseph Fernandez was known as Tomas Castillo while he was the CIA's top man in Costa Rica in 1985 and 86. He's charged with lying to investigators looking into the Iran-Contra affair and conspiring to defraud the government. According to the indictment, Fernandez and his co-conspirators operated a secret supply network to support military activities by the Contras. Attorney Lawrence Stasel of the Independent Counsel's Office would not say if former National Security Council aide Oliver North is one of the co-conspirators.
While the names of certain individuals appear in the indictment, the identities of the co-conspirators have not yet been named, and we would have no comment at this time as to their identities.
Each of the five counts carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. The indictment of Fernandez could mean that other senior CIA officials might also be indicted in the Iran-Contra affair. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
By unanimous vote, the Supreme Court today upheld a New York law designed to force most large private clubs in New York City to admit women. The court's decision could mean the end of all large exclusive male clubs across the country. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
The reason for the wide-ranging effect of today's decision is that many major cities already have laws like New York's, and others are poised to adopt them now that the High Court has given the constitutional all-clear signal. The New York law bans all discrimination based on sex, race, or religion in any club with over 400 members, where meals are served regularly, where rooms are rented out for non-member functions, and where members are reimbursed by their businesses for club expenses or deduct club expenses from their taxes. As soon as the law was adopted, the New York Private Club Association challenged it in court, claiming it violated the club members' First Amendment rights to freedom of association. But today, the Supreme Court disagreed unanimously. There's nothing in this law, said the court, that prevents a club from excluding individuals who do not share the club's views. The law merely prevents the club from using race or sex in place of what the city considers to be more legitimate criteria for determining membership. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 20 points to close at 2083.93. Trading was very light at just 116 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 18 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The violin has a long tradition in jazz, even though the instrument's importance is frequently overlooked. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by violinist Billy Bang. It's called Live at Carlos One.
Like the jazz clarinet, the jazz violin has a visibility problem. The perception that the fiddle isn't a jazz instrument seems unhindered by the playing of Stephan Grappelli, Leroy Jenkins, John Blake, Ramsey Amin, Bernie Charles, Claude Williams, Charles Burnham, Jean-Luc Ponty, and more. Not to mention past greats like Stuff Smith, Ray Nance, Eddie South, and Joe Venuti. The best of the current crop of jazz violinists is Billy Bang, whose new album on Soul Note is Live at Carlos One, which is a club in New York. Improvising violinists fall into two basic categories, urbane smoothies like Grappelli and scratchy-sounding fiddlers like Stuff Smith. Billy Bang falls somewhere in the middle. His style is sweet and lyrical, but he also brings a woody sound and a dervish-like rhythmic sense to his playing. Here's Billy Bang on Going Through, which also demonstrates his gift for writing catchy melodies. For a few years now, Billy Bang has been seeking a musical balance between the creative and the commercial, which is a dangerous practice considering the drivel put out by fusion fiddlers like Noel Pointer and Sonia Robinson. Bang's increasing conservatism even prompted a split from the adventurous String Trio of New York. But don't worry, Billy Bang knows there's nothing wrong with a little sunny day dance rhythm as long as the soloist delivers the goods. Thank you. members of Billy Bang's sextet help him keep his prettiest or most laid-back tunes from sounding bland. Thurman Barker's marimba adds another fresh voice and woody presence. The great bassist William Parker and drummer Zen Matsura make the Caribbean rhythm swing. And while Bang plays more in tune than most jazz or blues violinists, trumpeter Roy Campbell and electric guitarist Oscar Sanders are a little less exacting. Their loose intonation keeps things from sounding slick. Contrary to popular belief, jazz critics don't hate music he can dance to. We just hate music that's all for the feet and leaves nothing for the head. But when Billy Bang's smoking, you can light either end.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence magazines. He reviewed Billy Bang's new album live at Carlos One on the Soul Note label. Fresh air. As dance critic for the Village Voice, Deborah Jowett is always going to performances. Over the years, she began to wonder what caused the role of the male dancer to decline in importance in certain periods and become prominent in others. Why is the image of today's vanguard female dancer forceful and angular, when at the turn of the century, it was of a well-fleshed woman with flowing draperies? In Jowett's new book, Time and the Dancing Image, she places the progression of dance in the context of the times, illustrating how political and social upheavals, and even discoveries in the sciences, were evident in the choreography of the day. Jowett begins her book with the image of the wood nymph from the 19th century ballet La Sylphide. I asked Deborah Jowett about that image.
The image of the sylph is of a filmy woman who is very alluring, perhaps demonic, unattainable. She seems transparent. She's very light. She flew even on occasion by wires. Yet she sought in La Sylphide and in some of the other ballets that are with similar themes, she sought out a human male who was naturally enraptured by her. And to him, she symbolized not only the ideal woman, but some sort of ideal vision of life.
Do you think this image of the ballerina as supernaturally beautiful has to do not only with the idealized notion of female beauty, but also with the impossibility of ballet technique?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way before. I think the whole point was the technique was supposed to look effortless, that you weren't supposed to see the technique in that way. I don't think that 19th century dancers or ballet masters had quite the image of that dancers have today of dancing as a life of sacrifice and mortification of the flesh. Those women had they worked hard, certainly, but they had lovers, they had husbands, they had children. They didn't take two classes a day, or think that their legs would fall off if they didn't take two classes a day. I don't think they thought of dancing as almost masochistic rite that some dancers today seem to think of it, ballet specifically.
That's interesting. Now let's talk about how that image, that idealized image of the woman dancer, changed at the turn of the century with Isadora Duncan.
Well, Duncan, of course, was opposed to everything that ballet stood for, and she was also opposed to the theater dancing of her day, vaudeville kind of dancing, skirt dancing. She came from California, she was born in San Francisco, where at the time of her birth in 1877, there was a strong sense of the outdoors, of natural life. There were already colonies in California where people wore loose clothing and ate healthy foods. So Duncan had that kind of background, and then she had very, very lofty ideas that she drew from her extensive reading, and she seemed to have the idea that dancing could be an art that was on the level with music and painting. So her role was not to look like, a sort of a nymph like the sylphide. She didn't want to look unattainable or otherworldly. She didn't want to look like a flirt, like a show dancer. She wanted to look like herself on stage, which was a very radical idea, a woman dancing to music who had strong feelings that she felt were equal to those in the music.
So Isadora Duncan was a dancer who really wanted to liberate her body, to have a fuller body if her body was fuller, to dance pregnant if she was pregnant, to dance in flowing garments. Do you think that her legacy has carried over into modern dance and that there is today that feeling of a body not having to be an idealized body to still be a good dancing body?
I think that there's a consistent line through modern dance. Most of the creators of modern dance, originally the main pioneers like Martha Graham and Doris Humphrey, were women. They were creating techniques based on their own body, and the idea was whatever their body was, it was what it was, and that's the body that would be dancing and on which the technique would be modeled.
George Balanchine in the ballet world was the choreographer and dance master most associated with that perfected, thin, almost anorectic body in dance. Do you think that he's guilty? Do you think he was guilty as charged?
I suppose he would have the guilt for not stopping it if he had wanted to stop it. But what happens is that the idea gets promulgated that Balanchine likes thin women, and then the women do it themselves. They remodel their bodies to suit the image that they think he liked. It's certainly true that in his early days in this country, many of his dancers were not tremendously thin. And there were always dancers in the company who were fairly well-fleshed. But it's certainly true that he liked that thin look. He thought it made movement look clearer on stage, that you could see the body better, that clothes hung well on it, they didn't interfere with the line.
We've discussed some of the changes in women dancers' bodies and in the idealized notions of womanhood. What about men dancers? Have there been corresponding changes in the image of male dancers?
I think so. I think some of the earlier male dancers were very rough and ready, and I know that the Russian dancers around the turn of the century were pretty bulky because one of their main jobs was lifting the women around. And because male dancing's been disprized, it's kind of fallen down sometimes, gotten weak. Now it's extremely strong, and also I think in this country, because men are starting training earlier as they do in Europe, that you get a very beautifully developed body and among very young men who can do a great deal.
Yeah, you attribute that in part to Nureyev in a way of thinking that Nureyev helped disassociate the image that only sissies dance.
Yes, I think he and many others, I think Eddie Villela did the same thing. Yes, there was Jacques d'Amboise mounted a real campaign to make the male ballet dancer an acceptable image. But I think Nureyev caught the public imagination because he had done something very daring, which he had the nerve to risk death to escape from what he considered to be an intolerable artistic life.
There have been a lot of dancers and even groups in the past few years who have really moved more toward a dance of ordinary movement, a kind of vernacular style. Do you think that in its extreme that that's dead-ended?
Well, I disagree with you. I think that the heyday of vernacular style came in the 1960s, and I think there's been a gradual reasserting of virtuosity and dance prowess, even in the most vanguard modern dance circles.
That's interesting.
But I do think what you're seeing, perhaps, is that they want to look like people. They don't want to look, have that rarefied look of the that's typical of the trained dancer, at least that way we think of the trained dancer. They want to be able to do anything technically, but they want to look as if they're just ordinary people when they come out on stage. I think Twyla Tharp had a lot to do with that image, that you look just like you were a hard-working person, but you could do incredible things.
You used to dance before you became a dance critic?
Right, I did dance.
What kind of dance?
Well, it was modern dance, at first very traditional modern dance, and then sort of toward the more radical, but never fully radical. I worked with Dance Theatre Workshop a great deal in the 60s when that was not a producing organization, but an artist's collective.
Why'd you give it up?
Well, I think it gave me up. I had been writing criticism and dancing and choreographing for quite a few years all at the same time, and gradually the writing sort of took over, and I got older, and my body was less eager to push through a lot of injuries to dance, and so gradually I just stopped. I don't think of myself as having stopped, but I guess I've stopped.
Do you ever find yourself envying the dancers and their youth when you're watching a performance?
Well, not usually when I'm watching a performance, but when I'm watching a rehearsal, sometimes in a studio, I feel like an old racehorse. I want to get out there and do it. And when I go to class, I feel it's as if, even though my body might be not in the shape it was, it's as if I've never been away. That's a very special world, and once you belong to it, you never can quite shed that feeling of being part of it.
Deborah Jowett's new book, Time and the Dancing Image, is published by Morrow. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What you got?
Well, Haiti is in the news today. Colonel Henri Nampfi, who stepped down as president just 4 months ago after an election there, has now stepped back up. Nampfi has declared himself the ruler of Haiti, deposing President Leslie Maniga, and we'll have a couple of stories on that. Also, the Supreme Court ruled today that it is unconstitutional for private clubs to exclude women, or men for that matter, even if the club receives no federal funding. And we pay a visit to the Century Club in New York, or rather the front door of the Century Club. It's very elite, it's private, and they've never let women in as members.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The highlights of recent history are stored in the vast news archives of the major television networks. Television critic David Bianculli would like to see the networks take advantage of this great resource more frequently. He wants Try to Remember, a CBS pilot hosted by Charles Kuralt, to become a series.
Where were you in the second week of August, 1969? Try to remember.
Before we get back to the summer of 69, let's try and remember the summer of 87. Those were the days. Ronald Reagan was in the White House, TV's most popular program was The Cosby Show, and Oliver North and the Iran-Contra affair were in the headlines. Okay, granted, things haven't changed that much in 1 year. Even nostalgia has its limits. But one thing has changed. Last summer, ABC canceled Our World, the show hosted by Linda Ellerbe and Ray Gandolf. That show devoted each installment to a season of history, winter of 68, fall of 49, and it was great. But its ratings weren't, so now it's a memory. The networks have such valuable news footage in their vaults, though, that any TV show examining the past still has a promising future. This Thursday, CBS delivers on that promise by presenting Try to Remember, a pilot for a new series hosted by Charles Kuralt. It's very much like Our World. It couldn't help but be, except that it looks at 1 week's worth of events instead of 12. The week chosen by CBS is, of course, a whopper. Between August 10th and 17th, 1969, Hurricane Camille ripped through the South, Woodstock attracted 500,000 people for 3 days of rock and roll, and the Apollo 11 astronauts were released from quarantine and given a ticker tape parade. CBS's anchorman at that time, Walter Cronkite, wasn't at Woodstock, but he did attend a Chicago parade for the astronauts.
Down State Street. Again, if you have color such, you might be able to see that the normally yellow line down the center of the street has been painted red, white, and blue for the occasion.
Most people do have color sets these days, and if they tune them to try to remember, they'll see lots of powerful images. Floods in Mississippi, riots in Ireland, Janis Joplin at Woodstock. Witnesses from these events are interviewed, just as on Our World. And another thing Try to Remember has in common with Our World is that it's often the words, even more than the pictures, that make the show special.
O.J. Simpson, the highest-paid football rookie of 1969, arrived at training camp. He was unable to find a helmet that fit, was issued the wrong uniform number, was jeered by one teammate and ignored by others, and dropped the first pass thrown to him. He got better.
Try to Remember isn't on CBS's fall schedule, but it'll probably be back at mid-season, right after some of CBS's new series go down the toilet. If CBS continues Try to Remember, they ought to think seriously about replacing Kuralt with Walter Cronkite, or teaming the two as co-anchors. Not that Kuralt isn't wonderful, but CBS has to find something for Cronkite to do that won't step on Dan Rather's toes, and this could be it. Besides, what better way to end Try to Remember than to have Uncle Walter say,
"And that's the way it was, August 10th through 17th, 1969.
David Boone Cooley is television critic for the New York Post.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. What does professional wrestling have in common with some cartoon shows and religious programs? Well, the people behind them can buy their way onto television. Tomorrow, I'll speak with journalist Irvin Munchnick, who's writing a book about wrestling. Rock historian Ed Ward will profile the Kinks, one of the first British invasion groups. And book critic John Leonard will review Women in a River Landscape, the last novel by the late German author Heinrich Böll. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Dan Cornwell. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.